Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Every politician has to talk taxes sometime.
The country's taxes must be fixed, and I know what to do with it. If you think you're paying too much now, just wait till I get through with it.
Well, now, that's pretty clear. But how about this? President Obama was asked if he could keep his promise not to raise taxes on people who make less than $250,000 a year, and he said,
I can still keep that promise, because as I said, about two-thirds of what we've proposed would be from money that's already in the healthcare system but just being spent badly. And as I said before, this is not me making wild assertions.
So what does that mean? Talking taxes without music and very little comedy on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, September 21st. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
And it's a very special Monday morning, I have to say that. Good morning, co-host Celeste Headlee. Coming up this hour, new details on the terror probe that resulted in three arrests over the weekend, breaking down the Sunday NFL action, and discipline for kids in the 21st century. Does discipline mean love is on hold? Parents to kids. A discussion later on in the program.
But first, Kathleen Hall Jamieson joins us. She's the director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Kathleen, Obama was all over the Sunday shows yesterday working to sell his health care plan. From what you heard from the president yesterday, has he come off the defensive?
On Afghanistan, yes. On taxing and health care reform, no.
Well, that's brief but very clear.
She's
Kathleen Hall Jamieson, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
Well, in the headlines, Celeste, the top commander in Afghanistan warns the mission could fail without more troops. Not entirely unexpected. He calls for an urgent change in strategy. That's the details from the Stanley McChrystal confidential report in the Washington Post this morning. Stanley McChrystal is, of course, the commander in Afghanistan. President Obama talked about Afghanistan on CBS this weekend.
My job is to make sure that we get a strategy that focuses on my core goal, which is to dismantle, defeat, destroy Al-Qaeda and its allies that killed Americans.
But much of the president's media blitz, and it really was a blitz over the weekend, was all about health care. We're going to talk about that more with Kathleen Hall Jamieson. And he's going to continue that tonight. The president is going on David Letterman.
It's a busy week for the president. He's also going to speak at the UN, hold talks with Israeli and Palestinian leaders, and he'll attend the G20 Economic Summit in Pittsburgh on Thursday. Three men are under arrest in a terror investigation. They head to court today on charges that they lied to investigators. One of the men was trained in explosives in Pakistan. The men were arrested in New York and Colorado over the weekend.
House Democrat is giving Bank of America until noon today to release documents on its merger with Merrill Lynch. The bank argues those documents are protected by attorney-client privilege. Congress says nonsense. Wall Street gained just a bit on Friday. The Dow opens today at 98.20. The S&P starts trading at 10.68. The Nasdaq begins at 21.33. Futures trading suggests a negative opening, but they were wrong all last week, those futures traders. President Obama goes on David Letterman tonight. What are the top 10 things he shouldn't say?
He should definitely say nothing about you lie.
Case in New York tweets us. He should say nothing about Kanye. Give us a top 10 list of what President Obama should not say on Letterman tonight. 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can even tweet us at thetakeaway.org. Top 10 list.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Oh, let me get this straight. You're going to be here every day now?
Every day.
Every single day.
That's right. So
you're
you better
the co-host.
Keep yourself in line.
Permanent co-host.
That's correct.
What a sigh of relief. I think I'm going to cry.
Don't cry.
Welcome to The Takeaway, Celeste.
Thank you. Thank you. I don't know if you're a channel surfer, John,
totally
but
am.
You'd have to have surfed a lot yesterday to avoid President Barack Obama. He was on ABC, he was on NBC, CBS, CNN, even Univision. He talked about everything from Acorn to Afghanistan, but mostly, of course, he was talking about healthcare. And he's going on Letterman tonight, so we're going to make a top 10 list of things he should not say when he's talking to David Letterman. Tell us what you think at 8778-MY-TAKE. Send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can also tweet us through our site at thetakeaway.org. Here to talk about the president's, everyone's calling it a media blitz, over the weekend, and how he's doing in getting his healthcare message across to the American public is Kathleen Hall Jamieson. She's the director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome back to the program, Kathleen.
Thank you.
So we asked you earlier, he has seemed to be on the defensive with the healthcare plan in the past, and you're saying he's still there, from what you heard yesterday, still defending the healthcare plan.
He has to defend the healthcare plan because in the interview exchange format, someone is asking a question. If it's a reporter, the question is going to be tough. And as a result, it's going to look as if the response is defending. The question is, when was it defensive? And the answer is on the extended exchange on taxes with George Stephanopoulos, where the question is, if there's a required mandate, what's going to happen to people who think that they're paying more than they otherwise would, and that constitutes a tax if they're middle class?
Well, let's hear that extended question and answer for George Stephanopoulos.
But you just decided, you know what, I want to take my chances. And then you get hit by a bus, and you and I have to pay for the emergency
room. That may be, but it's still a tax increase.
That's not true, Georgia. It is absolutely not a tax increase. What it's saying is that we're not going to have other people carrying your burdens for you.
It may be fair. It may be good public policy.
No, but George, you can't just make up that language and decide that that's called a tax increase.
I don't think I'm making it up. Merriam-Webster's dictionary. Tax, a charge usually of money imposed by authority on persons or property for public purposes.
George, the fact that you looked up Merriam's dictionary indicates to me that you're stretching a little bit right now. Otherwise, you wouldn't have gone to the dictionary to check on the definition.
So, the old dictionary trick.
So, Kathleen, how do you think that played in American homes listening to that exchange between the two of them?
Anytime you are able to say that constitutes a requirement that you pay something you weren't paying before and it's government offering the requirement, it's a reasonable question for people. Is this not a tax? The question is it a tax they want to pay, and do they consider that breaking Obama's promise from the campaign?
Why is this such a big deal that they go so far as to look up the definition of tax in the dictionary?
Because in politics, people contest language. They disagree about what things mean. Recall the ongoing debates about what constitutes a cut as opposed to a reduction in the rate of increase in Medicare over the last decade and a half. And as a result, because taxes are something very personal, they affect us directly. Anytime you can affix that label to something, it's a problem for a politician.
Well, coming away from all those appearances yesterday, do you feel like the president is making headway with his health care plan and his message to the American taxpayers?
Yes, I do, because he's able in an extended format to communicate first by his manner that he cares and that he believes there is a real problem here. The public agrees there's a problem, as well as do Republicans. That comes through. Secondly, he's able to offer one piece of statistical evidence that is important. The rate of increase of insurance costs last year was higher than people's increase in paychecks or the increase in what they paid for anything else. Inflation was actually dropping as health care costs were rising. If he can get people to see that their costs are spiraling out of their control and they will lose insurance if they have it as a result ultimately, then the argument shifts to his ground. He was trying to do that yesterday. He was trying to argue he's going to help the middle class, even as George Stephanopoulos was pressing to say, but isn't that going to cost the middle class something it might call taxation?
So you're saying he was successful in making the case that this isn't really a tax increase?
I'm not saying he was successful in making the case. He was successful in making the case that there's something that's valuable that's being purchased for what government is going to be spending. The question then becomes, do you believe that with the elimination of some things in some places, the recovery of money from the system, he's going to gain enough of it that the cost on the individual, the unsubsidized cost, because some will be subsidized,
right,
is not going to be onerous.
Well, Kathleen Hall Jamieson, you're great at this, and it seems to me there are two channels working in an exchange like this. There's the explicit discussion of policy and the implicit sort of body language and vocal tension about whether you're on the defensive or not. What do you think speaks louder to voters out there watching?
The manner matters, and overall, in an extended interview, the manner will come across, I think, in Barack Obama as one that was deliberate, thoughtful, caring, particularly for those, of course, who are disposed to believe him to begin with. Those who are opposed are going to read it in exactly the opposite way, conniving and manipulative. But when a reporter is on the offensive, that is, offensive, maybe offensive to some as well, and the candidate or the president is responding, there's always going to be a sense that the president is defending. And as a result, the natural frame on it is going to be to say he was on the defensive, even if he was answering the questions well. In the tax exchange, I think the label taxation is going to stick.
Hmm. Interesting.
So another important discussion when we're talking about language is last week the White House responded to Joe Wilson's "You Lie" outburst during the president's speech. White House says it has nothing to do with race, and here is Barack Obama talking on Meet the Press.
This week you had former President Jimmy Carter saying most of this Republican opposition against you is motivated by racism. Do you agree with that?
No. Look, I said during the campaign, are there some people who still think through the prism of race when it comes to evaluating me and my candidacy? Absolutely. Sometimes they vote for me for that reason. Sometimes they vote against me for that reason. I'm sure that was true during the campaign. I'm sure that's true now.
Well, of course, Obama is famously well known for talking about race in a very effective way. Is he continuing that?
Yes, he is. And contrast the tone in that response to the tone in the taxation exchange that you just played. And the reason for saying that overall the interviews appear to be thoughtful and deliberative is that the second tone is more common to more of the interviews. Also, when you have an extended chance to listen to an individual talk with you, you have a better sense that you know the individual. And to the extent that this format is an effective one for President Obama, it is one in which people are able to say, I may disagree with him, but I am more likely to believe that he's sincere, non-extremist, and that I can trust that at least he believes he's doing the best thing for the country. That's communication functioning at a primal, nonverbal level.
Okay, Kathleen Hall Jamieson. Also, you know, one more thing in which he seems to have changed his message was about Afghanistan. Here's President Obama explaining the current course of action there.
What we're going to do is continue to reassess, review what's taking place, and make sure that our strategy and resources fit together for the aim of making sure that Al-Qaeda is not able to attack the United States.
Is that the beginning of a backpedal there?
It's the beginning of a very strong act of reassurance, and it is the part of the argument that he has not yet decided about the troop increase, about a troop increase. It is also phrased elsewhere as the strategy needs to come before the resources. So one doesn't simply put more money, put more individuals in before one gets the strategy right. This is an instance of the candidate saying, I'm thinking this through. I'm not acting precipitously. If, to the extent that he is going to continue to engage in Afghanistan, that's the best rhetorical posture he can be in.
And that comes across as reassuring in your view.
I believe it comes across as reassuring and thoughtful, and particularly important for a candidate coming from a party that traditionally is not perceived as being as astute as the other party on military affairs until, of course, the last war.
Right. Well, Kathleen Hall Jamieson, all these subjects are likely to come up on Letterman tonight. President Obama is the only guest, and I was reading somewhere that David Letterman believes that because he was so soft on Obama during the campaign, that he was responsible for his election in some sense. Who knows about that? But that signals that he may be tough on Obama tonight. Our question to listeners is, what are the top 10 things Barack Obama should not say under any circumstances on Letterman tonight? What do you think?
He shouldn't mention the word taxation in any way that makes it plausible that he's thinking about the idea. I think if asked the question, he should say that if we don't do something about our health insurance costs, they're going to go up faster than David Letterman's salary.
Nice line.
We also ought to remember something about David Letterman. In past elections, his interviews have been as tough as anything on network television. David Letterman is an extremely strong interviewer. And his interview with John McCain during the election, I think, did as much damage as his interview with Obama helped President Obama, then candidate Obama.
Kathleen Hall Jamieson is the director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Always great to have you with us. Thanks so much.
I think she wants to get on Letterman.
She could get on Letterman. She'd probably do well.
Coming up, what's on tap for the week ahead, the agenda later this hour. And remember how intelligence agencies were consolidated after 9/11 under one agency? Now there's efforts to consolidate financial regulators into one agency. Louise Story has more on that in just a few minutes.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Barack Obama has his work cut out for himself. He's going to be on Letterman tonight talking about all his various policy initiatives, including health care. We're assembling a list. What are the top 10 things Barack Obama should definitely not say on Letterman tonight? Well, while he's thinking about that, and you are as well, for a moment today, the president's focus will be on something of a pet project of his, using higher education and high-tech jobs in partnership to revitalize troubled urban areas around the United States. The president will visit Troy, New York, and we're joined by Professor Rich Porter, who is the department chair of Building Systems Technologies at Hudson Valley Community College in Troy. Professor Porter is also an HVCC alumnus. Professor, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, first of all, in your community, how's it working? Community college training and high-tech jobs and Troy, how's it working?
I think it's working fairly well. We are expanding constantly. We've got a record enrollment again this year. This is the fourth year in a row. I think since the economic downturn started that people are going back for job training, and it's increased to the point where we're literally bursting at the seams with students.
And Obama's going to talk potential today. We should note Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute is one of the best engineering schools in the nation, and that's nearby your community. But why does Troy still have double the national average of people living below the poverty line, do you think?
You remember Troy was a mill town for many, many years. And a lot of these former mill towns, once the manufacturing businesses closed up, there was no high-paying manufacturing jobs anymore. And The people exited to the suburbs looking for different jobs, and the housing deteriorated, and it became housing that low-income people could afford. So I think once jobs come back and the opportunities there, I think you'll see a turnaround.
All right, and that, of course, is the theory that President Obama is going to be talking about when he speaks, that communities like yours are poised for a bounce back. Listen.
It will reform and strengthen community colleges like this one, from coast to coast, so they get the resources that students and schools need and the results workers and businesses demand.
Professor Porter, does your institution receive federal money, and has that increased under the Obama administration?
We do receive some federal money. We got some grants from the government, I think, for workforce development, which directly applies to what you're speaking to. That came in last summer. Unfortunately, it's not my department, but a different department within the college.
All right. You got a ticket for the president's speech today?
I did.
All right.
I got a ticket Friday night late. We worked through the weekend preparing the college and the building for the president's visit.
All right. Well, good luck to you later today, and I hope the president says what you need to hear. Professor Rich Porter is a department, the chair of Building Systems Technologies at Hudson Valley Community College in Troy, New York. Thanks so much.
Regulators! Mount up!
Louise Story is here with some details on a story that broke over the weekend. You'll remember how after 9/11, President Bush decided to consolidate all intelligence agencies under a single department. Well, Senator Chris Dodd, who heads the Senate Banking Committee, wants all financial regulators under one agency. Louise, a finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, Uber regulation. Who thinks this can work, Louise Story?
So there are certainly some people in the Senate that do, and Chris Dodd, who is the leading Democrat on the Senate Banking Committee, plans to make this central to the Senate version of the bill, which makes the Senate version very different from the Obama administration's proposal.
And does that mean the Obama administration won't support this, or is it kind of wait and see as things shake out this week?
You know, what I heard over the summer from a number of people in the House, as well as people close to the administration, was that, you know, they could recognize that there may be some wisdom in having a single regulator, but there's a trade-off here. The trade-off is that it would take a long time to merge four regulators. We're talking about merging the Federal Reserve, the Office of Thrift Supervision, the Comptroller of the Currency, and the FDIC into one, and that could take years. And meanwhile, the banks might go a little unsupervised or not very well supervised while you were doing such a big merger. So I think there's a lot of people in Congress who can see the wisdom of it. They're just questioning whether it's practical.
And I guess this week we will see if Congress actually is going to move forward with this. Certainly Chris Dodd has a lot of steam behind him and his ideas. Louise Story, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, down in Washington this week following the regulators. It's Football Monday morning in America, and we turn now to Nando DeFino, who's a Wall Street Journal sports reporter here in the studio. I mean, I guess the late story last night and the big story is the Giants looked for real in Jerry Jones' palace down there in Dallas, beating the Dallas Cowboys 33-30, something like that?
Yeah, late field goal. They look great. Big day for New York football teams.
Big day for New York football. Does that mean Eli Manning is the quarterback of the Giants is for real? Does that mean Tony Romo has to worry, or is it just too early to say?
I mean, it's not too early to say anything, but Manning, you know, he's got a Super Bowl ring. He's on a roll, even without the Plaxico Burress thing.
Plaxico Burress, the wide receiver who's out, actually on his way to jail for shooting himself in the leg.
Yeah, unfortunately for Giants fans. But the receivers picked up the slack. Mario Manningham, I think he's a story. He established himself really as, you know, everyone knew about Steve Smith, but Mario Manningham's the guy who came out of nowhere. He had 150 receiving yards, and Manning seemed to like him.
I feel sorry for the play-by-play people for the Giants having to do Manning and Manningham in the same play. You know, that's tough. So the big story, though, it seems to me, the Bears beat the Steelers. Huge, right?
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely.
And Favre looked good against the Detroit Lions. Excuse me,
I'm sorry.
Celeste.
You're
I'm
laughing
sorry.
When you say the Lions.
Oh, Favre did win defensive. Against the Lions. I guess that does count, right?
Favre, the story there is he set a record in the NFL for most consecutive games played.
Most consecutive games played. But and he's
the Lions also set a new record.
For more
19
losses?
19 straight losses.
Yeah. Well, a lot of records. It was a historic moment
right.
There. And the big story, it seems to me, though, is on the West Coast. You've got the San Francisco 49ers, who look like they're the real deal. They've won two in a row, and they were very convincing yesterday.
Oh, yeah, and that's 2 weeks in a row where I think Mike Singletary has really kind of instilled a whole new attitude there, kind of like what Rex Ryan did with the Jets here. It's that new coach and a little fresh blood, and, you know, they're hitting hard and they're playing tough, and it's almost like a new style that they're picking up.
And the 80s Bears were my team, so I'm all with Mike Singletary, who, of course, was a great Bears player in the 1980s. And what about the San Diego Chargers? They also look like a powerhouse.
I mean, their team that lost, LaDainian Tomlinson is the MVP a couple years ago, and I mean, he's not even playing for them, and they're just running all over everybody right now.
All right, speaking of running all over everybody, the New York Jets, who actually very few people predicted to beat the New England Patriots, actually did yesterday in one of the early games on Sunday.
Sanchez with time, throwing, corner in the end zone, touchdown! Dustin Keller!
Man, is Dustin Keller tough on the Patriots.
We just didn't make enough plays to win, and that's, like I said, that starts with me and involves everybody that was, you know, goes for everybody that was involved in the game.
Are the Jets for real or are the Patriots just faltering?
No, the Jets are for real. I mean, you said it was awesome driving around last night at 8 o'clock and just seeing the Empire State Building green. They had to be happy for him.
I wondered if that was the deal there. Nando DeFino, thanks so much. Wall Street Journal reporter talking about sports. And coming up on the week ahead, we'll check the agenda. Marcus Mabry is here in the studio.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, we'll take a look at what's going to make headlines in the week ahead. It's the Takeaway Agenda in just a moment. But right now, let's look at some of today's top stories. The top U.S. commander in Afghanistan wants more troops. The Washington Post has new details on General Stanley McChrystal's report. In financial news, Bank of America has until noon today to disclose secret conversations about its merger last year with Merrill Lynch. Congress ordered the information last week, but the bank says the communication is protected by attorney-client privilege.
More people living with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia than scientists expected. That's according to new reports, which put the number at more than 35 million people worldwide. And scientists predict that number will nearly double every 20 years. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. It was a perfectly fine children's book, but it made 30 million big bucks at the box office over the weekend. It was the number one vote getter at the box office. The Informant came in second, the Steven Soderbergh movie with Matt Damon. It got 10.5 million. And the Space Shuttle Discovery scheduled to land at Florida's Kennedy Space Center today, hitching a ride across country on top of a modified 747. It had to land at Andrews a week ago. That's some of what we're watching today.
Our government.
Healthcare.
Your government.
The economy.
Bailout.
Global financial recession.
Transportation.
Agenda.
Agenda.
The work that needs to be done.
I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. It's Monday morning, and we all know what that means, trying to check out what's on the agenda for the week ahead. Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
We're also joined by Andrew Walker. He's the economics correspondent for our partner, the BBC. So, Marcus, we have the terrorism probe in Colorado where those suspects are going to be in federal court today. What do you make of this story? It's another homegrown terror plot, supposedly.
It's both a scary story and at this point still a pretty open story. We're not quite sure what the plot was. What we do know is that Najibullah Zazi and his father, he's a young man in his 20s, who actually admitted and went through volunteered for marathon sessions by the FBI to discuss his own travels to Pakistan, where he actually received training. It was left in a rental car here in New York. He had left actually a bomb-making manual. So it's kind of at this point when these and this has happened before in these terrorism cases, one of these cases where you kind of are kind of gobsmacked by the amateurness, the amateur hour that seems to be at play here, yet we're talking about someone who is resident here, who has traveled there and received terror training, most likely from Al-Qaeda. What we know right now is only from the court documents, which laid out those details I just laid out. We hope to have more information this week.
But they're not being charged with terrorism.
Exactly. They're being charged with lying to investigators, which would, of course, have resulted from that marathon session.
And Eric Holder says it's not, the Attorney General says it's not an ongoing threat. That's when he spoke yesterday.
Exactly. So that's why we're left, again, to puzzle this out and say, well, how serious was this threat? Because we still don't know the details. We still don't know what they were trying to target. So it's hopefully we'll have more clarity this week going into the story.
Now, we also have heard, speaking of terrorism, President Obama says Al-Qaeda is still the main focus in Afghanistan, although he seems to be changing his story maybe a little bit about the strategy there, maybe setting the stage for reducing troop numbers, even as General Stanley McChrystal says we have to get more troops there.
And it's going to be interesting. The president was talking about a lot about this weekend and all of his marathon, do every Sunday talk show in the country sessions. He was talking a lot about strategy. I think he was actually trying to say, however, we're not going to just send more troops without knowing that our strategy is right. I think he's trying to set it up actually so he could do the opposite. I think he's trying to set it up so he actually could say, well, I always said it was about our strategy. I always said our goal was to protect Americans because Afghanistan is where 9/11 came from, unlike the Iraq situation. So we're there for a reason. We're there to protect Americans and to keep Al-Qaeda from forming a base as they had that allowed them to attack us on 9/11. So the president was very clear about that. And I think that would allow him to then say later on, now we know what our goal is. We think our strategy is sound. Stan McChrystal is there. Now we're going to request more troops. I think it was all paving the way for that because I think given the stark assessment that the General McChrystal gave about the situation there, without more troops we will lose, I think it would make it impossible for any president to say no to that.
Oh, Andrew Walker, BBC economics correspondent. So another thing coming up is the G20. It meets this Thursday in Pittsburgh, and I'm sure that we're going to be talking a lot about banking reforms at the G20, and they're going to try to get the U.S. involved in that. What are you expecting from the G20?
Yes, there certainly is going to be a lot of talk about financial regulation, and the U.S. has got an agenda of its own there that it's pushing quite enthusiastically, of trying to reform international agreements on bank capital standards, how much they have to put aside to deal with unexpected losses. And there's some significant differences there with some countries in continental Europe who fear that what the Americans have in mind would force their banks to go running to the markets, having to raise extra money from shareholders. But I think that, frankly, is terribly important, but not the real headline-grabbing stuff. That is going to be about bonuses. And what they're going to have is a report back from a new agency, the Financial Stability Board, which was created after the previous G20 summit, which is going to come up with some guidelines on how bonus arrangements should be structured to try and discourage excessive risk-taking. But I think the big controversy would be about whether there should be any kind of quantitative limits on how much banks should be able to pay. The French President Sarkozy, very enthusiastic about that. Americans and British, not so much.
Not quite so. Now, Marcus, another thing that the president was talking about yesterday was Acorn. And many of us have seen this tape over and over where they're encouraging a prostitute to say that she's a performing artist so she can qualify for benefits. And President Obama said this about the situation.
Frankly, it's not really something I've followed closely. I didn't even know that Acorn was getting a whole lot of federal money.
And yet he also said that he supports investigation of Acorn. Are we expecting to hear a lot more about that organization this week?
Well, I think this week it'll be a question of, can Acorn survive?
Acorn is a community activist group. If people don't know about it, it gets some sort of money like a lot of community activist groups do.
Absolutely. And does lots of kind of on-the-ground stuff and kind of one of these things
grassroots
actually.
Grassroots sort of.
Exactly. Everything from housing to housing support to you know, kind of advocacy for the poor. And so growing up in Trenton, and on welfare in my family, we were very aware of kind of their activities and stuff. And it was kind of one of the few voices out there speaking on behalf of the poor. But I think that politically speaking, I think it's a very different issue. I think whatever good they were doing on the ground is really going to be endangered now because of this bad that happened that the whole world knows about now. And I think they're going to have a hard time surviving.
Marcus, do you believe Barack Obama called David Patterson and said, don't run?
Oh, the story.
Governor of New York.
The story we have in today's paper is just withering. It paints these scenes of kind of the same time that the president was down here on Wall Street, his political director was up and meeting with Patterson and saying, we would suggest you not run again.
What should Barack Obama not say on Letterman tonight? Top 10.
I think he should say he should not tell Letterman that he lies.
Marcus Mabry, that's your agenda. International business editor for our partner, the New York Times. Also, Andrew Walker joined us from our partner, the BBC. In Washington, D.C., Andrew Walker is stateside. Coming up, our family discussion looks at whether love is withheld when parents decide to punish their kids. That's our discussion. Stay with us in 10 minutes.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Celeste Headley. Over the weekend, two German ships did what probably hundreds of sailors have hoped to do in the past. They became the first ever Western commercial vessels to sail the Northeast Passage from Asia to Europe. That's a shipping route that goes via the Arctic. It's been impassable for centuries. It's now possible because, well, the polar ice caps are melting, probably from global warming. Richard Galpin is the BBC's Moscow correspondent. He watched the ships complete their journey when they landed in Russia over the weekend. Richard, good morning.
Good morning to you.
So what did the ships look like? Had they been battered about and dented by ice?
Absolutely not, actually. They look completely normal, medium-sized cargo ships. You wouldn't really know what they'd done without actually getting on board and talking to the crew. And certainly the captain we spoke to was very, very excited about it. You know, he said that he used to actually sail the eastern part of the route when it was the Soviet Union 20 years ago. And he was saying that there was lots and lots of ice then. And when he came through this time, it really was a huge, huge difference, saying there's so much less ice than before, and the fact obviously they can sail through. But he's saying it's a dream he'd had since childhood to actually do this route, and now he's one of the first to do it.
So obviously the sailors themselves and probably a lot of commercial shipping companies are very happy about this, but environmentalists are not quite as happy.
This is very clear signal how weak is now the Arctic ice. Really heavy ice became in Russian Arctic 10 times smaller than 10 or 20 years ago.
That's Alexei Kakarin. He's one of the people. He's a Russian environmentalist, certainly not celebrating the passage of the ship through the ice. Were there other environmentalists or organizations there bemoaning, I guess, this opening of the ice?
Not up actually in Archangel, which is where we met the boats when they came through. But certainly, you know, obviously the environmentalists as a whole are extremely worried about this because they firmly pin the blame on global warming, as do probably the majority of climate scientists. They say this is the reason for it. You know, and if you look at the models, the photographs taken, for example, by NASA satellites over the past 30 years or so, I mean, you're seeing dramatic shrinkage in the polar ice cap, which of course means it is possible to take this route because the ice in summer now has shrunk back from the coast of Russia. So there's this clear route through, which, as you say, you know, certainly the shipping companies are delighted about it because the northeast passage is much, much shorter than the normal route, which goes, the traditional route goes to the south, you know, around India and then up through the Suez Canal into the Mediterranean. So this is a much faster route. But I have to say, you know, the big caveat on this is that it's only in the summer so far that this is possible, that the ice has melted away. Although the captain said to us, you know, if this climate change continues as it has done over the past few years, maybe it'll even be possible to do it in the winter as well.
What about sovereignty issues there? Who owns this route? Who's going to be able to control it?
Well, you know, obviously it depends on what territorial water you are in, but certainly when you come up... if you go up from Vladivostok on the eastern side of Russia and then up to the northeast corner of Russia and then along the coast, it is Russian territorial water there. So, you know, there is probably a requirement to, I mean, certainly at the moment, like these ships had to pay various fees, and it was actually very bureaucratic for them to do it. They'd hoped to do this trip a year ago, but just got caught up in Russian bureaucracy. It didn't happen. And even now, even though they had all the permissions, but when they're
still
in Vladivostok,
difficult.
They had to wait another month before they could move because they just got caught up in a huge amount of paperwork.
Thanks. Richard Galpin is the BBC Moscow correspondent.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, our family discussion asks the question, is parental love and discipline, are they mutually exclusive? When you discipline your child, what are the consequences? We're going to talk about that in just a moment. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE if you have a particular opinion on this story. We're also getting calls from you about President Obama. He continues his media blitz. He's going on Letterman tonight. What's the top 10 list of things he should not say?
My name's Carrie, and I'm calling from Royal Oak, Michigan. Many of us would probably hope that he'd say this, but he probably shouldn't say that the health care reform package will pull the plug on only one grandma, Sarah Palin.
Other things Obama shouldn't say, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. First, here are some of the news stories we're following this morning. Top commander in Afghanistan says the mission there could fail without more troops. The details from General Stanley McChrystal's reporter in the Washington Post. Three men under arrest in a terror investigation head to court today, charged with lying to investigators about an alleged terror plot.
We talked about the president's appearance on Letterman tonight. It's just part of a busy week for him, including meetings with world leaders at the UN and the G20 summit in Pittsburgh. And at the Emmys last night, it was a three-peat for 30 Rock. The NBC show took Best Comedy for a third straight year. In the Best Drama category, AMC's Mad Men won for a second year in a row. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
Family time on Monday morning here on The Takeaway, where we try to get a discussion going around the family table. And joining us are Alfie Cohn, author of 11 books about human behavior and education, including Unconditional Parenting, Moving from Rewards and Punishment to Love and Reason. He joins us from Boston. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Dr. Perry Klass, pediatrician and professor of journalism and of pediatrics at New York University, author of The Mercy Rule, a novel, in our studio. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
So let's just do a little focus group, all right? Celeste and I are both parents.
Correct.
And the idea of discipline and punishment and behavior modification for kids, is that something that, in your experience, is easy to develop a consistent policy about?
Oh, it's impossible. A consistent policy? No.
You have one child. I have four.
It's consistent that I will discipline my child.
It's consistent you will discipline your child, but the rules at age two could change. At age six could change.
They could change from 6 a.m. to noon.
Well, there's the challenge. And Alfie Cohn, we should say you've done it again in publishing a recent article about discipline and what you've discovered in some of the latest studies. When a parent's I love you means do as I say has caused a lot of blowback. First of all, describe what it is you're positing to parents here in the 20th century about discipline.
Well, in any century, but we have more research in the 21st, it turns out that what kids need is not just to be loved, but to be loved unconditionally, which means not for what they do, but for who they are. It turns out that what matters most for kids is to experience that parents do not give them more approval and attention and acknowledgement and care when they, the children, do what pleases the parents, when they're well-behaved, and conversely, that parents shouldn't withdraw affection or do anything that kids could experience as love withdrawal, which would include what we call time out, when the kid doesn't do what we want.
Now, what evidence do you have that kids lose the idea that their parents still love them when they're being disciplined with a time out?
Well, no one has done a systematic survey of kids to ask them about that experience. I think it's telling that psychologists who write on the topic in journals classify timeout under the category of love withdrawal. And anecdotally and logically, you often see that kids, especially young children, who are forcibly isolated from their parents at a time of conflict, which is what timeout means by definition, will not just be able to say, oh, well, mommy and daddy still love me. It's just that I've done something bad. That's a very tough thing to parse even for an adult. The reality is that when you ask young adults to think back on their childhood, many of them do say that they felt that love was taken away,
although
when they didn't act the way the parents wanted.
Although there are plenty of adults who don't remember discipline that way. Here's an adult who, well, he's not a psychologist, but probably has a higher profile than most.
We need to go back to the time, back to the day when parents saw some kid fooling around. And it wasn't your child, but they'll whoop you anyway.
So, Perry Klaus, there's a great deal of diversity in terms of how families and communities deal with discipline and their children, right?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I have to say, speaking as a pediatrician, when we talk about using timeout, we're usually not talking about it as a way to encourage parents to be more severe. We're usually talking about it as a way to get through difficult family moments without screaming, yelling, hitting. In some cases, we're offering it as a sort of a strategy for parents to take their own reactions and their own emotions to a child who does something that upsets them and not lose control.
But let's elaborate on what Alfie is saying. I mean, do kids perceive discipline as a love moratorium on the part of their parents in your view or in your experience?
It's a hard thing for me to say because, Alfie, I think what you were talking about there was very young children. You weren't necessarily talking about how we react to our 6 or 8 or 10 or 15-year-olds.
Well, timeout isn't usually used with kids in the upper range
there. Oh, if only it could be.
I think you're right, Perry, that many pediatricians and psychologists tell parents, don't spank. Give them a timeout instead.
And don't question, scream and don't, don't lose it.
If the question is timeout better than spanking, the answer is probably yes. And for that matter, spanking kids is better than shooting them. But that's not much of
an
argument for it.
Oh, thanks. Good. I'll write that one down.
I got to play the devil's advocate here because I came from an African-American family and I never once thought my grandparents didn't love me because they smacked my hand away from the macaroons. I don't remember ever thinking that my mother didn't love me because I came home with, a report from my teacher saying that I'd goofed off in class and, she gave me a swat on the behind.
Well, let's look for just a moment at the new research that was that I wrote about in the New York Times, building on research that was done 5 years ago by the same group. They found, number one, that a lot of young adults did think of their parents' love as conditional, which I think is interesting because almost all parents would strenuously deny that that's true, say we love our kids no matter what. But that's not what matters. What matters is the child's experience of it. I'm glad your experience personally was not of conditional love, but I'm afraid we can't say that for all. But and the second thing they found is that those kids who did feel more loved when they did well in school or when they acted in a nice way, etc., or less loved when they did something that didn't meet with the parents' approval, those young adults now resented their parents. They felt more controlled.
Hang on, I'm going to stop you just right there for a second. Perry, we're surveying young adults, teenagers, asking them if they resent their parents. Aren't we kind of setting the parents up for failure here?
Well, or I don't know. It's always hard when you look at something retrospectively like that. You don't know whether your questions are, I don't know how to say it. Whether you're picking out a particular subgroup of the young adults who feel victimized or resentful, or whether you're actually looking at what prospectively went on going forward.
Right.
Alfie, I think here's my somewhat guilty question as a parent.
Yeah.
Don't we have, in my experience as a parent and as a pediatrician, even 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds are pretty smart. And if you don't like the way they're acting and it's upsetting you and it's not pleasant, they know, even if you're trying to cover it up and be as dulcet-toned and loving as you can.
Quickly, Alfie, we'll give you the last word.
In unconditional parenting, I try to lay out what it means to work with kids to solve problems together when those things happen, rather than doing things to kids.
Alfie Cohen, author of 11 books about human behavior and education, including Unconditional Parenting. Dr. Perry Klass, pediatrician and professor of pediatrics and journalism at NYU. Thanks to both of you. A lot of conditional parents were responding on our website after those two were on the air. You can go to our website now. Mary writes about Alfie Cohen. His recommendations seem like the perfect way to raise a self-centered, spoiled brat. Hector writes back, it's remarkable how people respond to a suggestion that kids be treated with respect and care and assumes this means permissiveness and will spoil the child. You know how to reach us.
Takeaway.org. And you can also let us know about what you think President Obama should not say when he goes on Letterman tonight. We're making a top 10 list.
He shouldn't mention the word taxation in any way that makes it plausible that he's thinking about the idea.
I think he should not tell Letterman that he lies.
That's Kathleen Hall Jamieson from the University of Pennsylvania and Marcus Mabry from the New York Times. Tell us what you think at 8778-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Terror arrests in Colorado.
The break came at the FBI offices in Denver. 24-year-old Najibullah Zazi had been grilled for 16 hours over the last 2 days. Officials say he finally admitted he had ties to Al-Qaeda. But authorities say they found videos of New York's Grand Central Station in Zazi's computer.
I've got things to do in Denver. Things I've got to do alone.
Authorities say he didn't act alone, but the arrest of Najibullah Zazi suggests that Al-Qaeda may be alive and well in the USA. The FBI is looking into dangerous things to do in Denver. We're not dead yet. Details coming up on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, September 21st. I'm John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee, co-host.
With a capital C.
Yes, indeed.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, an all-star group of controversial world leaders is in New York this week. President Obama is there, too, and we're going to preview the diplomatic drama going on at the UN. Plus, getting to know a special envoy will get the dirt on Richard Holbrooke.
And we're going to learn a little more about Celeste Headlee in just a moment on the program. But first, Bruce Finley, reporter for the Denver Post, who broke the story of those arrests over the weekend. Bruce, are Denver residents feeling like it's a little more dangerous place this morning?
No visible manifestations of alarm, I think, just following the details of the case as we look into it.
And we'll be following those details as well. Bruce Finley, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, the Washington Post has new details on the report from the top American commander in Afghanistan. General Stanley McChrystal says the mission there could fail without more troops. But which comes first, the troops or the new strategy? Here's President Obama on Meet the Press.
Until I'm satisfied that we've got the right strategy, I'm not going to be sending some young man or woman over there beyond what we already have.
McChrystal's report is now under review by the president and his top advisors.
The three men accused of lying to investigators in that terror probe we just mentioned head to court today. According to court filings, one of the men told FBI agents he was trained in explosives at an Al-Qaeda camp in Pakistan. The men were arrested over the weekend in Colorado and New York. The president's talk show tour ends on a comic note today. Well, if he's lucky, he's on David Letterman tonight. Then it's on to a busy week. President Obama will speak at the United Nations, hold talks with Israeli and Palestinian leaders, and attend the G20 summit in Pittsburgh. On Capitol Hill, a House Democrat is giving Bank of America until noon today to release documents on its merger with Merrill Lynch. The bank argues, no, attorney-client privilege.
Wall Street gained just a little bit on Friday. The Dow opens today at 98.20. The S&P starts trading at 10.68, and the NASDAQ starts out at 21.33. President Obama, as we said, he is going on David Letterman tonight, and he's been going on kind of a media blitz with lots of intense scrutiny. So we're asking you, what do you think he should not say? John, what should he not say? Top 10, what should he not say on David Letterman?
Let's be clear. If there are death panels, panelists will not get Wall Street-sized bonuses. Let's be clear. I'm 99% sure I was born in the USA.
Tell us what you think, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. This is Celeste Headlee. Three men were arrested this Saturday by the FBI, two in Denver, one in New York, after a week of some kind of confusing events. 24-year-old Najibullah Zazi and his 53-year-old father, Mohammed Wali Zazi, were both arrested in their Aurora, Colorado apartment. Agents also arrested Ahmed Afzali in Flushing, Queens. Zazi and his father were not arrested on terror-related charges.
The allegation is that Mr. Zazi lied when he said he had no knowledge of 9 pages of handwritten bomb-making material on his computer.
So that's Commissioner Raymond Kelly of the New York Police Department. We have with us Bruce Finley, a staff reporter for the Denver Post. Bruce, can you give us exactly what do we know about this? Do you know what they were supposedly targeting in those 9 pages of explosives manuals?
The latest is the release of these documents, early Sunday affidavits, asserting that the driver admitted al-Qaeda training and had bomb-making notes in his laptop. He and his attorney had broken off their voluntary talks with the FBI abruptly Saturday after 3 days of questioning. And we'd interviewed Mr. Zazi out here before the FBI detained them back on Tuesday. He said at the time to us in his doorway there is no way I can have any connection to this terrorism. But certainly these affidavits began to make a little more of a case. According to the affidavit, he allegedly told the FBI in Denver that if the handwritten notes that were found on his computer, if they were there, he must have unintentionally downloaded it as part of a religious book that he had downloaded in August.
So basically, he was not arrested on terror charges. He told them he had no connection with al-Qaeda, and that turned out to be untrue. And he told them he did not have bomb-making instructions on his computer, and that turned out to be not true. And that's what he's been arrested for. Is that correct?
That's correct. Federal charges of making false statements is the legal basis for the arrest at this point.
So David Johnston is also with us. He's a Justice Department reporter for our partner, the New York Times. David, they've also arrested a New York man. What was he arrested for?
He was also arrested on charges of lying to investigators about conversations he had with Mr. Zazi. In a sense, if you take this from the government's perspective, their view is that these charges really reflect their suspicion that something serious was afoot here, although they are not yet able to define with clarity what it is.
There's also reports that the NYPD maybe jumped the gun in arresting.
The New York police and the FBI are longtime rivals in many areas. These are two big agencies that bump into one another on a lot of things, and they've struggled over terrorism in part because it's a very serious matter in New York. You know, for example, in another city like Washington, where there was an attack at the Pentagon, the police defer to the FBI, but not in New York. There's a very aggressive intelligence function, and there's always finger-pointing when there are these kinds of cases.
Well, let's take it beyond the finger-pointing, though, if we could. David Johnston, Justice Department reporter for the New York Times. ABC News reported two things that I wonder if you can confirm or if you have any information on, that Najibullah Zazi agreed to testify or to give information about al-Qaeda in the course of these investigations. Do you have anything on that? That's what ABC News is reporting. And secondly, that there were pictures of Grand Central Station in New York on the computer of Najibullah Zazi, which might have something to do with the New York connection and Ray Kelly's concern here.
The essential piece here is that Mr. Zazi was dealing with people in New York, and that raised concerns that there might have been some targeting in New York. Look, they have no target here. They have no timing. Mm-hmm. And they're not really even sure what the method or means was. They interrupted this thing long before it ever had any real definition. In many of these cases, we see laptops that are confiscated, and there are images and websites downloaded, and these can either have a sinister interpretation or be quite benign. It really takes investigation to understand how serious this may be.
So, Bruce Finley, what are you getting from the law enforcement agents there in Denver? Do you feel like there's information that they're holding back, more details about the story that we have not heard yet?
That's unclear. The U.S. attorney here declined comment. The affidavits certainly only need to give enough to have probable cause for the arrests, but it was interesting that they were able to establish during these lengthy interrogations over 3 days that Zazi had said that he was attending courses at an al-Qaeda training facility in the tribal region of Pakistan and that he received instruction from al-Qaeda operatives on subjects such as weapons and explosives. Mm-hmm. Certainly in our own interviewing of Mr. Zazi, at first we were just sort of confirming his story, you know, born in Paktia province, coming over to Peshawar as a boy, and then moving with the family to Flushing, Queens, and then earlier this year to Denver, sort of just trying to confirm details that we'd heard from an aunt and an uncle before. But there was a hesitancy, sort of a bristling at some point, and several times on phone conversations he wanted to, you know, punt to the lawyer. So at this stage, I think the ball's everyone is watching to see what that extra evidence
right.
might be beyond the false statements.
Well, one of the things that distinguishes this investigation from a lot of others that we've reported on in the past, and I want to comment from you, Bruce, and then maybe David, Bruce Finley, staff reporter for the Denver Post, David Johnson of the New York Times, there doesn't seem to be an informant in this, I hesitate to call it a conspiracy, in this group that's sort of suggesting targets and designing the so-called attack. I mean, these guys were acting independently. Is that your view, Bruce? And then I want to comment from David.
I think as far as target and timing, you know, what we'd reported during the week from some authorities that there was no specific information regarding timing, location, or target. Assistant Attorney General Chris on Sunday acknowledged the same. So I think we haven't seen any details suggesting a plot along. They've asserted that it's part of an international plot to detonate homemade bombs in the United States, but there's only that one
right.
sentence in the affidavits, and that's not substantiated in any way
right.
at this stage.
David Johnston, any indication of an informant here, like in some other investigations?
Well, in some of these other cases that we've seen in recent years, the government has inserted a cooperating witness who, in the minds of some, have really laid out the kind of plot that more or less entrapped people into participation. There's not that kind of indication here, although we know so little at this stage. There may be informants and sources here that we're not aware of. One thing that's happened here is that authorities, particularly in New York, where this week there's the UN General Assembly meeting, were extremely hesitant to let this go forward to develop into the kind of clear-cut kind of plot that might have evolved if they'd watched it over a few days. Of course, they didn't have that opportunity because Zazi was, in a sense, tipped to the investigation, and they decided to just move forward before they really knew what this was going to turn into.
Now, from what I understand, David, they copied his hard drive and found photos of Grand Central Station and maybe some links to internet sites of some public events in New York City. Is there any mention of these places as possible targets?
Or of the UN, even?
Yeah.
No. There is apparently no clarity as to whether any sites he downloaded would relate to targeting. What he had with these notes, and it was an image of some notes about making improvised explosives, they knew he had had training, and they knew he was able to move easily around the United States. Their fear is of a person who is a westernized but committed al-Qaeda kind of figure who can move in this way and without a great deal of sophistication can do some damage. But I don't think that at this point there's any clarity really as to what the intentions of Mr. Zazi were.
That's David Johnston, Justice Department reporter for our partner, the New York Times. We also heard from Bruce Finley, staff reporter for the Denver Post. Thanks, guys. You can find out more on this story by going to thetakeaway.org, where we've linked to Bruce Finley's reporting in the Denver Post that includes some excerpts from intercepted phone conversations and interviews with the Zazis and their relatives.
The thing that confuses me here is that these were handwritten notes on bomb making.
Right,
but they were found
in
the computer. So he had to scan them in. You don't just do that accidentally.
Well, he
That's
says he did.
Well, but no.
He accidentally
That's
dropped
suspicious.
Them on the scanner.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, maybe that's totally wrong, but from the details I'm looking at, it seems like he would have had to scan bomb-making manuals into his computer. That is a little suspicious. So on another subject, outside of speculation, we are asking for your help. President Obama has been on a media blitz. When he goes on Letterman tonight, the David Letterman Show, what shouldn't he say to keep people happy and behaved? We're making a top 10 list.
My name is Nancy. I'm calling from Cambridge. I don't think President Obama should say anything about taking money from Medicare to help with health care reform.
That'd probably be number 9. Where do you think this would be on the top 10 list?
Hi, this is Chris, White Lake, Michigan. I think one thing that the president shouldn't say tonight is, hold on a minute while I give Kanye West the microphone.
That's got to be number 1 or 2.
That's close to the top. What do you think? 8778 My Take. Send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org or tweet us through our website, thetakeaway.org. David Letterman has a reputation for being a tough interviewer when a lot's on the line, and a lot is on the line. He's the only guest tonight.
That's right, and the first sitting president to visit that show. Yeah. Coming up, we're going to get
maybe the last.
Preview of this week's meeting of the UN General Assembly. That's later in the hour. We're also going to talk about what's ahead this week on Capitol Hill with Todd Zwillick. Stay tuned for that.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us. In our last episode, you may recall Max Baucus laid an egg with the Baucus bill out of the Senate Finance Committee. And even though President Obama tried to seize the initiative on health care reform over the weekend, the action still is in the Senate. As this bill comes into focus in the Senate, Todd, how many amendments are we looking at here?
Oh, we got a grand total, John, 564 in the Finance Committee.
Holy moly. So how does that track where this bill is headed this week?
I have never, ever seen a markup with this many amendments on it. I'm not sure anyone has. So you mentioned that Max Baucus laid an egg, John, and that's not a bad description. This markup this week will determine whether the Senate, you know, will swallow a hard-boiled egg or maybe a fried egg. Maybe something totally deviled. I mean, they're basically, to extend the metaphor, if you'll forgive me, they're going to change this bill a lot, and it's going to have to change. And the whole point of this gigantic markup, which normally, you know, this is the sausage making of legislation. We don't usually pay much attention to markups. We pay attention to bills when they reach the floor, you know?
Right.
But this bill is so big and so important, and everybody's paying so much attention to it, that this is going to be a packed session of legislative paper passing and legislative sausage making. You know, 564 amendments. Look for things from the liberals, from like Jay Rockefeller, from John Kerry, striking that co-op, get it out of there, give us a public option, lower the amount of financial commitment that middle-income people have to pay. Look for lots of amendments from Grassley and the conservatives, no more fees on drug makers, no more fees on health insurance. They wouldn't mind getting rid of the co-op either. This is going to be the roadmap to tell you whether or not this bill has a chance of grabbing one or two Republicans. Olympia Snow, will she vote for this coming out of committee? It'll tell you if this bill has any chance of ever getting to 60 or if the Democrats are going to have to go that notorious reconciliation route, which is 50 votes, which is a very, very difficult situation, blowing up a lot of relationships in the Senate.
Well, from metaphorical eggs to metaphorical sausages there, Todd Zwillick, thanks so much. What we want to do is have you look through the 564 amendments and see if there are any hand grenades in there designed to actually scuttle the bill entirely. We'll talk to you about that maybe tomorrow. Todd Zwillick, of course, Takeaway Washington correspondent in Washington, D.C. Thanks, Todd. And our finance wizard, Louise Story, has a story this morning about how Congress is trying to use its leverage to open up Bank of America's corporate secrets to public scrutiny. Some in Congress are focused on that controversial merger with Merrill Lynch. Louise Story, our contributor, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, joins us now. Louise, so who wants to get inside Bank of America's private records?
So you have this House committee that has held a few hearings. They're the ones who brought Ken Lewis and the former Secretary of the Treasury, Hank Paulson, and questioned them this summer. But now they're saying that confidential documents between the bank and its lawyers should be given to them. And it's raising questions about whether those documents will be made public to all sorts of parties like the SEC and Attorney General Cuomo in New York, who would also like to know what the lawyers told Bank of America at the end of last year.
And Cuomo has already issued some subpoenas in this case. I guess the question really is, if taxpayer money is involved, the principle that Representative Adolphus Towns apparently is promoting here, is that if there's taxpayer money involved, attorney-client privilege doesn't apply. Does that basically outline what they're arguing?
Well, when Congress is involved, attorney-client privilege does not apply. So even if there were no taxpayer money, the fact that it's Congress asking for it carries a very different weight than the SEC or an attorney general who do have to, in many cases, abide by the rule of attorney-client privilege. But Congress doesn't have to. And the bank has asked Adolphus Towns, the representative who's pushing this, they've asked him to please follow attorney-client privilege because they know that if it gets waived here, it'll get waived everywhere for the other investigations. And there's also a number of shareholder lawsuits about this. So we'll see if he changes his mind, if Representative Towns changes his mind. But he sounds pretty determined to get these documents, which will probably change the case in a lot of places.
I'd love to know if Bank of America actually used the word please in asking them to honor attorney-client privilege.
Well, what? Ken Lewis wrote him a pretty, you know, pretty nice note. And nice. But I don't remember if I saw please in there. But it was a nice note asking for his understanding.
What if Bank of America refuses, Quigley?
Well, I mean, if they refuse, Mr. Towns can issue subpoenas and he'll get them because there is not a legal ground that they can stand on to not do what Congress wants. So it might just take a little longer, but if Congress wants it, they can get it. Representative Towns is meeting tomorrow with a woman from the bank who's in charge of their public policy. So that's Ann Finucane, and she's going to try to change his mind tomorrow. So we'll see what happens today, if the bank supplies them or if it keeps fighting not to supply those documents.
Right. And Louise Story, the deadline is noon today. At least that's the first deadline.
That's right. That's right. And as of last night, I called Representative Towns' office, and they said they're sticking to the deadline.
All right. A showdown in Congress. Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much from Washington. So, ready, set, go. Celeste Headlee, co-host of The Takeaway. Welcome to The Takeaway family.
Thank you very much.
But in the interest, you know, we always want to get to the bottom of things. We need to come up with a takeaway about you, okay? Because we don't know that much about you, right? Our listeners don't know.
I know a lot about me.
We've got a little quiz. All right, you just moved here, right?
Right, that's right. I moved here from Detroit.
We share a certain amount of geography. You grew up in the Pacific Northwest, right?
No. I lived in the Pacific Northwest, right. But I grew up in Los Angeles and Orange County, and then I was in Arizona, Flagstaff, Arizona, right, for 10 years or so.
Well, we share Michigan and the Pacific Northwest.
There you go. And now New York.
And ethnic diversity we don't necessarily share.
That's an interesting question because I'm an African-American, Native American, Jewish, Spanish in there somewhere, and many different layers of Caucasian.
So that's the diversity hit parade.
Correct.
Right there, indeed. Yeah. But I mean, there's a great rich story in your family that we're probably going to hear about.
There's lots of them, but probably the one that people get when if they ever Google my name is my grandfather. Of course, it was William Grant Still. He was the dean of African American composers and one of our most lauded and awarded composers.
There's a scholarship in his name at USC.
There is a scholarship. Actually, there's a scholarship in his name, I think, at Oberlin and maybe Arkansas.
Wow.
But
that
scholarship is in my dad's name, who is a marine geologist.
Celeste Headlee, favorite beat?
Native American issues.
Favorite story you've ever covered?
Toilet smuggling.
Favorite mainstream movie?
Lord of the Rings.
Oh, come on. But what about obscure movies?
Adaptation.
Adaptation, I see. And what do you have to do to get comfortable in New York City? Get your furniture?
Furniture would be a good thing.
More on Celeste Headlee going forward on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Celeste Headley with John Hockenberry. We'll talk about this week's UN General Assembly meeting in just a moment. But first, let's check on today's top stories this morning. The top commander in Afghanistan says the mission there will fail without more troops. The Washington Post has new details on General Stanley McChrystal's report. More on that in a few minutes. Three men will be in court today as part of a probe into an alleged terror plot. They're charged with lying to investigators.
Here's something disturbing. Researchers say there are more than 35 million people worldwide with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, more than scientists thought. And earlier research underestimated Alzheimer's growing impact on developing countries. At the box office this weekend, the animated film Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs took the top spot. Steven Soderbergh's The Informant took second place. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So, John, Gaddafi, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and President Obama all walk into a bar. Okay. Actually, they walk into the UN, but
it's funny all by itself.
It's the beginning of a pretty good joke. It's this year's UN General Assembly in New York. 192 member countries of the UN all going to get along beautifully together there, right? This year, the U.S. is playing a big role. President Obama will be attending some of the proceedings this week, and he's also going to be speaking before the U.N. We spoke earlier this morning to Jonathan Marcus, a good friend and regular contributor to the show from our partner, the BBC. He's the diplomatic correspondent there. We asked him what to watch for this year with the United States at the U.N.
I think it's really interesting this year for a number of reasons. One, because it's President Barack Obama's first U.N. General Assembly. This is the moment where I think you are going to see him setting out a re-engagement with the world. This is not an institution that the previous administration much liked. And we're going to hear some very interesting speeches, I think, from the president, particularly on climate change tomorrow, on non-proliferation later in the week, where I think we're going to hear America recommitting itself to a whole range of agreements and treaties which fell out of favor under the previous administration. And of course, there's the big issue of Mideast peace, too. We don't know whether this meeting tomorrow with Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is going to necessarily lead to a restarting of the peace process. But they are in town, they are going to be meeting, and we'll see what happens.
One thing we do know, supposedly, is that President Obama is going to try to avoid both Gaddafi and Ahmadinejad. Are we expecting some sparks to fly between the president and...
I think what you're going to find is a kind of diplomatic disengagement. I think they're going to try very hard not to bump into each other in the corridors. I think there's an awful lot of kind of orchestration and arrangement behind the scenes to try and make sure that these guys don't actually meet up. I mean, we're expecting probably President Ahmadinejad to be there when President Obama speaks. It's not entirely clear whether Mr. Obama will be there when the Iranian leader speaks. And of course, behind the scenes, there are an awful lot of important meetings as well. Afghanistan very much in the news today. Mm-hmm. There's a meeting of the Friends of Pakistan. One of the most important bilateral meetings is going to be with President Obama and his Chinese counterpart, because actually it's that American-Chinese relationship which is really the crucial one in trying to sort out whether the climate change agreement is going to get anywhere.
Well, that is supposedly the main focus of this entire General Assembly. And China and the United States are the two sticking points, many people say.
Well, they are sticking points. I mean, in a sense, everybody is a sticking point. That's the problem. I mean, nobody can really agree, other than the fact that there is a problem. But nobody really has agreed yet how much people should cut, how fast, who's going to pay for it. So it's a hell of a problem, and we're getting a lot of warnings now.
I'm wondering if the headlines are going to be centered more on the U.S.-Iran relationship, where Ahmadinejad said on Friday that the Holocaust was a lie. It actually didn't happen. Seems to me it's possible that the whole overture to talk directly to Iran may be dead by the end of this week. What do you think?
Well, look, I think nobody's terribly optimistic. I think the process is going forward. I mean, it's clear in October the Europeans, the Americans, the Russians and so on are going to be meeting with the Iranians. So, you know, there are very limited expectations. But the game now is to try and see, to push out, see where that engagement can get to.
Does the decision that President Obama made about the missile defense shield, some say it's a concession to the Russians, will that encourage the Russians to speak talk tough to Iran?
Big question. I mean, everybody is looking to see, is there going to be some quid pro quo? Now, of course, administration officials, everybody says this wasn't a concession to the Russians. You're getting a real missile defense shield rather than a virtual one. But all eyes are on Moscow to see if there is going to be any kind of softening at all, any assistance for America and the West on Iran.
That was Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC, who joined us earlier this morning.
And Jonathan said that Afghanistan is the big news this morning, and that's going to be one of the subjects of meetings that are going to take place this week. We've been talking, it's been our top story all morning long. The commander of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, General Stanley A. McChrystal, has warned in a confidential report to Defense Secretary Robert M. Gates that he needs additional troops in Afghanistan by next year, or the conflict would, quote, according to the Post, likely result in failure. The report was sent to Gates on August 30th. It was released last night, apparently, to the Washington Post, which reports on it this morning. We've already had discussions about Obama's alleged strategy in Afghanistan, him wanting to focus the Afghanistan military conflict more on the question of al-Qaeda. And Marcus Mabry of The New York Times said this morning that that was a way of paving the way for asking more troops. Although it's unclear whether more troops will actually go.
And what the public response will be to that, there seems to be eroding support for any troops in there, let alone more.
Well, certainly mulling all the details of the Washington Post story are reporters and everyone else in Washington. Eric Schmidt joins us, terrorism correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Eric. And what are people saying about the McChrystal report details? They're not a surprise. It's expected that he would call for troops. But at some point, the Obama administration is going to have to make a decision here, right?
Yes. I mean, the broad outlines of what General McChrystal said in his report have been widely known. He's been very concerned about refocusing the counterinsurgency effort to protect the populations. He's trying to revamp NATO and the forces on the ground in a more effective counterinsurgency force. He's warned of the growing effectiveness of the Taliban. But what this report does in very stark language is lays out some of the problems and, as you said, basically gives his prescription that he needs more forces. He doesn't say how much. That'll come in a separate document. And he needs them soon or else the mission in Afghanistan, the eight-year mission there, will likely fail.
Obama spoke over the weekend about focusing the effort in Afghanistan on reducing al-Qaeda's effectiveness. But as we know, there's an extraordinary nation-building program going on in Afghanistan. Is the al-Qaeda argument an argument for more troops, or is it an argument for staying the course and not bringing more troops in?
No, the president has not yet, you know, cited one way or another whether he'll support more troops. But clearly, General McChrystal, as well as other senior commanders, Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, has also sided with him. It basically said to have an effective counterinsurgent strategy on the ground, you're going to need more forces to protect that area and prevent Afghanistan from reverting to a safe haven as it was prior to 9/11 for al-Qaeda. It's a nuanced argument that the president, frankly, hasn't made as clearly as he possibly could have and will have to be doing more so in coming days for people to make the linkage between why it is that the U.S. needs to be on the ground in large numbers when al-Qaeda, that is, is Osama bin Laden, is in Pakistan next door.
And we haven't had an attack in 8 years. Finally, Eric Schmidt, is there any consensus within the foreign policy community about more troops? It appears the Pentagon is of one mind here.
No, right now you're seeing divisions, I think, within the foreign policy community at large. I think most counterinsurgency specialists, however, would side with General McChrystal. However, there are those that are arguing that the more troops you put in, the more you could possibly alienate the Afghan people and lead to greater problems.
Well, Eric Schmidt, terrorism correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, thanks so much for joining us. Coming up, is Afghanistan President Obama's Vietnam? It's a question for Richard Holbrook. We'll talk about that in 10 minutes.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And at the Emmy Awards last night, the doctor was in the house.
I'm super honored to be here. I'm a big fan of television. I grew up on television. I just love it. I love sitcoms, hour-longs, infomercials, you name it. I'm a reality show junkie. News, not so much.
Well, he may have made news last night. Neil Patrick Harris, Doogie Howser, hosted the Emmy Awards last night, and the initial ratings suggest that he did pretty well. Joining us now is Delana Dixon, TV blogger and founder of DelanaDixon.com. First of all, Delana, how did Doogie do at the Emmys last night?
Well, I think that Neil Patrick Harris was, wait for it, legendary. He was really great. He opened the show in the first 3 minutes with a Tony-ass feel. He had singing. He had dancing. He gave love to John Hamm from Mad Men. I mean, what could go wrong?
He's hugely talented.
He is.
It's embarrassing to look at him.
He was hugely talented. And we definitely saw kind of the man boy that Neil Patrick Harris is actually famous for. And I think he was a little bit nervous in the first few minutes, and that was nice to see, too.
It seems the big headline was Toni Collette won the Leading Actress in a Comedy Series award, not Tina Fey. Here's her accepting.
Wow,
Oh, this is insanely confronting. Thank you so much to the Television Academy for recognizing our show in this way.
Insanely confronting. Maybe that's why the show was canceled.
Well, I think everybody was expecting Tina Fey to take it for the third time, but Toni Collette on her show plays a schizophrenic, and she plays four roles. So when you're playing four types of crazy, that can probably win you an Emmy.
The United States of Tara is the name of the canceled
Absolutely.
Show. Absolutely. Yeah. And Tina Fey, of course, at 30 Rock. But Mad Men was the big winner also last night.
Can't believe this. What an incredible year. The election and then this and... We all want to thank the voting members of the Academy for recognizing our show again. We worked very hard to not have it stink the second year, and we're very proud to be here.
So Matthew Weiner, creator of Mad Men, accepting the Best Drama Award. There, you get a sense of a somber ceremony and pageantry. He was hoping the second season didn't stink.
Well, it didn't, obviously, because it got a third season. You know, Mad Men is a critical darling. It hasn't really gotten the ratings that of a big show like Lost or 24, but it's that stylized look of the show and the clothing that keeps people watching, and it's the writing is so great. It's on cable, so they can kind of step outside the rules of broadcast television.
In many ways, Emmys are awards for shows that maybe aren't so successful. Kristen Chenoweth actually won an award for a show that's not on the air anymore. And here is an even more important, perhaps, sign of the future of the Emmys.
That's the plan. Rule the world. You and me. Any day.
That's Neil Patrick Harris in Dr. Horrible, which was nominated for an Outstanding Special Class Emmy for a viral video.
I know. Isn't this interesting that the internet can actually bring us television? As we know, it was created by Joss Whedon, who did it while we were on the writer's strike, something that he could do. And it's actually become an opportunity to prove that, yes, the internet is a viable source for programming. And it's something that's going to have to be taken into consideration for the future.
But maybe that's a great strategy for the Emmys. Focus on those kinds of viral videos, leave the TV shows behind.
Well, you know, the Emmy's biggest problem this year or in the past year has been getting shows that are blockbusters.
Blockbusters begin on the web. Maybe that's the rule.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Delana Dixon, TV blogger and founder of DelanaDixon.com, handicapping the Emmys, which happened last night. Thank you, Delana.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, is Afghanistan President Obama's Vietnam, or is it Richard Holbrooke's Vietnam? A profile of Richard Holbrooke in just a moment. We're also talking about President Obama, who goes on Letterman tonight. He's been going on a media blitz, lots of scrutiny, but we're going to make a top 10 list of things Obama should not say on Letterman.
Well, what President Obama shouldn't say tonight is, I'm happy to be here on your show, but I can't because I lie.
Rob from Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, had an echo of that. Here are a few of his ideas. In fact, I do lie. That's something he shouldn't say. Then there's death panels will just be like cash for clunkers for grandma. Yeah, you shouldn't say that.
Harsh.
Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Tweet us through thetakeaway.org. But first, some of the news stories we're following this morning, including during his talk show tour yesterday, the president said he wouldn't send more troops to Afghanistan until he was satisfied with the strategy there. Here's what he told CBS.
My job is to make sure that we get a strategy that focuses on my core goal, which is to dismantle, defeat, destroy al-Qaeda and its allies that killed Americans.
But most of the weekend media blitz was all about health care on ABC. He admitted he hadn't been clear enough with most Americans.
No matter how much I've tried to keep it digestible, it's very hard for people to get their whole arms around it. And that's been a case where I have been humbled And I just keep on trying harder.
More humility tonight as the president goes on the David Letterman show.
The three men accused of lying to investigators in a terror probe are in court today. Court filings show one of the men told FBI agents he was trained in explosives at an Al-Qaeda camp in Pakistan. And on Capitol Hill, a House Democrat gives Bank of America until noon today to release documents on its merger with Merrill Lynch. The bank says the files are protected by attorney-client privilege. And the IRS is giving tax cheats a few extra weeks to come clean. Americans who hide assets overseas now have until October 15th to apply for an amnesty program. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning. John?
We're going to take another look at Afghanistan in this last segment. U.S. troops have been fighting there for 8 years. And if you gauge the length of the U.S. involvement in Vietnam as from August 1964, when the Gulf of Tonkin incident occurred and the resolution was passed which authorized U.S. troops under President Johnson, if you gauge the war from then to April of 1975, when the U.S. evacuation from Saigon was completed, that war was also 8 years.
I don't have a deadline for withdrawal, but I'm certainly not somebody who believes in indefinite occupations of other countries.
Barack Obama, speaking there over the weekend, was a child during much of the Vietnam era. But the question of whether Afghanistan will become President Obama's Vietnam is a deeply personal one for the man in charge of policy in Afghanistan and Pakistan, Richard Holbrooke. I'm joined now by George Packer. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine with a profile of Richard Holbrooke in the current issue. Welcome, George.
Hi, John.
So, George, this article is filled with so many fabulous stories about how Richard Holbrooke began his career, his diplomatic career, in Vietnam. And indeed, when he was given the job and announced as the envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan, one of the people he singled out in the audience was someone he worked with in Vietnam. Tell us that story.
Right. Well, it was at the State Department on January 22nd, and John Negroponte was sitting in one of the front rows, and Holbrooke nodded to him and told the audience that they had first met in Saigon in 1964. They'd become roommates, and then he added, I hope we will have more success this time, or I hope we'll have a better outcome this time, and smiled. And Vietnam is, it doesn't haunt Holbrooke. He's not paralyzed by it. He's not ridden with the ghosts of it, but it's just there all the time, and it comes up all the time, even when he says he'd rather not talk about it. And by the way, I think you should probably date it from 61, because that's when American advisors first started going and dying in Vietnam. Holbrooke himself has said many times this war will be longer. This war in Afghanistan will be the longest in American history, and even longer than the 14 years of our involvement in Vietnam. That's something he was saying quite a bit until he got this job, and he's kind of toned down that kind of talk since he got the job.
Well, let's listen to the tone of Richard Holbrooke speaking in July of this year.
I believe, and I will take the position, that we have a national interest to help Pakistan through its troubles. This is not Vietnam. It is not an overextension of our efforts. It seems to me it's a strategic necessity.
You can almost hear the pulling back and the caution in his voice. Here's someone who's emailed, you report about it in your article, that it's worse than the Nam, comparing Afghanistan to Vietnam. Does he have a sense of that in your witnessing him moving around both Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Well, I think two things about that. First, I think Holbrooke truly believes that Vietnam, and he learned this the hard way by working on it for 7 years in his 20s, was a war that we didn't need to fight. We couldn't win it, and we didn't need to fight it. But I think he truly believes that we need to be in Afghanistan. We need to try to influence Pakistan, because this, unlike Vietnam, he thinks is directly connected to our security. There's a real strategic threat. On the other hand, how can he not see the parallels? We're trying to reform a corrupt and weak government in Kabul as we were in Saigon. There's a rural insurgency that is spreading through large parts of the country. There's an enemy sanctuary across the border in Pakistan. All of those things are eerily reminiscent of Vietnam. And I think the hardest thing to figure out, and the thing that Holbrooke and America never figured out of Vietnam, is how do you get another government on which our security seems to be riding, to become a better government? We don't know how to do that, and I think that's the thing that over and over again I saw Holbrooke running up against and looking for different ways to do it. He knows that it didn't work in Vietnam. He learned a lot from that war. In that sense, his experience in Vietnam, rather than crippling him, I think has been a help to him, And yet here he is facing something very similar in Kabul with the Karzai government, and I don't think he knows how to go ahead and do it.
Well, you know, he wrote, Richard Holbrooke did famously, that about Vietnam, the smartest guy in the room is often wrong. Holbrooke has a reputation for thinking of himself as the smartest guy in the room, and he has as many friends as enemies. You talk about that in your piece.
Well, and it may be that in years to come, historians will look back and say Richard Holbrooke didn't listen to the advice of people who weren't on the inside, just as Robert McNamara didn't listen to people who were not on the inside. But I also think, you know, I saw Holbrooke very closely in Afghanistan. He was doing what McNamara and Bundy never did. He was going to the source in province after province and really asking skeptical questions and informing himself about local realities and, in a sense, being more pessimistic and more skeptical than the commanders on the ground, which is something that McNamara never did. Instead, McNamara looked for commanders who would tell him what he wanted to hear. So, I mean, Holbrooke was an internal critic during Vietnam. He started out in a rural province in the Mekong Delta as a pacification officer, and because he was so close to the peasantry and to the rural war, he saw very quickly that David Halberstam and Neil Sheehan were reporting the real war and that official channels were not. So he has it. I think he has the ability to see beyond, you know, the blinkered view that inevitably government officials have because they see it through a bubble and through a bubble that's driven by the desire to bring good news back to Washington. But there's a limit to that, and it may be that right now there are people he should be listening to who just don't have his ear because they're not on the inside.
Well, that's really the question. You end on something of a pessimistic note in your story, which is kind of what you're saying right there, but all kinds of fascinating details. It's a profile of Richard Holbrooke in the latest edition of the New York Magazine, including he got everything he wanted when he took this post except his own plane in the New Yorker. George Packer, thanks so much for joining us. And there's a great picture of Richard Holbrooke in Vietnam back in 1963 in that piece. It's just amazing. You know, look how young he looks. And he's holding a great big bottle of, I presume, Saigon brewed beer. Yes, indeed.
On the back. I didn't get my own plane either.
You didn't?
No, I didn't.
Oh, gosh. You know, I use a plane to get here every morning.
Dang it.
Yeah,
I need to renegotiate.
It's very inconvenient. It's actually a pain. I wouldn't recommend it.
So when President Obama goes on Letterman tonight, what should he not say? We're making a top 10 list, and we want to know what you think.
Philomena from Westchester, I think President Obama should not reply, "You lie," to someone who yells out from the audience.
And they will be yelling in the audience, right?
I'm sure they may.
I mean, Letterman
it's
has a
David
lot of
Letterman.
Material. He has a lot of material. He's got cash for clunkers he can talk about. He's got the whole birth certificate situation to talk about. I mean, there's so many places he can go and not go.
It's going to be an interesting... Obama is the only guest tonight, so there's plenty of time to go to places that, you know, the president may not want to go to.
And Letterman, apparently over the weekend, it feels like he really helped Obama get elected by being so tough on Senator John McCain.
Tough on McCain and soft on President
Obama. Right, but he helped Obama get
Obama.
Elected. So,
that's what,
so maybe
that's
he's
what
gonna
Letterman
go after.
Believes.
He's going to go after him.
I don't know. Let's place bets. We'd like to hear what you think.
That's why we need your top 10 list.
That's right. We are compiling this top 10 list of things that President Obama should not say. For me, beginning with, good evening, Jay.
Oh, that's good. I think you should say that. Actually, that's a good one.
Give us
that's
a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Or you can tweet us through our website at thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, you can pick up our podcast so you don't ever miss a minute.
And I'm John Hockenberry. My new co-host is...
Celeste Headlee.
You can find out more about Celeste on our website, thetakeaway.org. It's quite an expose. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.